From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. You can't really be successful these days, in business, in school, or any other activity, without access to high-speed internet. In the counties around Baltimore, fiber optic networks deliver that high-speed access. In the city, it mostly doesn't exist. Why not? And what's the best way to fix the problem? Then, our movie regulars Jed Dietz of the Maryland Film Festival and Anne Hornaday of the Washington Post give Tom Hall their picks of some off-the-radar summer films you don't want to miss. Plus, a pop-up shop highlighting locally manufactured products springs to life on North Avenue. We learn what it's about from the owner of a screen print textile business and the owner of a sewing company. And a Baltimore story from Gil Sandler. First, the news.
I'm producer Jonna McCone. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Good morning. Glad you're with us on Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. There's fairly widespread agreement that access to reliable, high-speed internet is crucial to success. Businesses need it to deliver value to their customers. Students and teachers need it for effective education. Doctors and patients need it for quality health care. Researchers, police, elected officials, librarians, scientists, everyone needs it. No wonder dissatisfaction is growing with how and where high-speed internet is available in the Baltimore region. Fiber optic networks surrounding the city, but almost none in it. Whose responsibility is it to make sure Baltimore's businesses and residents have access to high-speed broadband? That's our question this morning. Charlie Carter is executive director of Maryland Working Families, a nonprofit that advocates for working-class families. It's generated a protest movement called Where's Our Fios that accuses Verizon of redlining Baltimore by not providing in the city the same high-speed fiber optic broadband it provides in the suburbs. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And also with us is Philip Spivak, co-leader of the Baltimore Broadband Campaign, which calls for a public entity to lead the way to bring faster, cheaper internet service to Baltimore. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Philip Spivak, when we spoke about a year ago, you said that Baltimore, quote, had not had an articulation of a vision and a plan, close quote, about broadband. Is there a vision now?
No, I don't think there still is an effective vision. The point our campaign's making isn't necessarily there has to be a public entity that's leading it. It's that there has to be some effective entity that's leading it on the public's behalf. So that can either be a municipal utility like Baltimore City, or it can be an entity acting on behalf of the city, such as a nonprofit that is outside of the city. And I think when we talked before, it was before the city had come out with its task force report. So the good news is that there has been a mayor's task force report on smart cities, and there's a consultant, Magellan Advisors, that the city's paid close to $250,000 for. That's good, but we think it falls short in not articulating, number one, what's the city's role in this? Are they going to lead it? Are they going to facilitate it? Or are they going to stand on the side and someone else is going to do it? It doesn't articulate what the vision is for the plan, clearly, in which we do agree that this has to be build the fiber out as far as you can into the city. And then finally, there's no clear organizational structure. Who's leading this? Who's executing it? Who's implementing it? So we hope that that will be an intermediate step to get to that place, but this has taken a long time to get this far, and we're disappointed it's going so slow.
Charlie Carter, you were quoted in the Baltimore Brew as basically saying, too, that the draft report that the city issued in June falls short. Why do you think so?
Well, in addition to what was just said, there's no mention of how residents in the city are wired, will be connected to broadband. It talks in detail about connecting libraries and educational institutions, schools, and but doesn't really say any much about business and doesn't say anything about residents. And we see broadband is not, it's not an add-on feature. It is something that's going to be essential to participating in a 21st century economy. And we cannot, you cannot put forth a vision that says we're going to have a smart city but leave the residents of that city out.
Am I right that you essentially accuse Verizon of redlining?
Yes. Verizon has, they drew a red line around Baltimore City. When you look at the map of Baltimore, there are neighborhoods that adjoin in the county and the city, same demographic, same economics, but they've chosen not to build in the city, even though they pledged to do so by 2010. It's a track record that Verizon seems to have, that they've also done the same thing in cities like Boston and Buffalo, cities that are comparable to Baltimore City. So the question is, with $47 billion in profits, why they couldn't build out in some communities like Baltimore City.
We asked Verizon to join this conversation. They declined, and they sent us a statement that I think you've seen elsewhere. We've posted it on our website. They essentially dismiss your protests, Charlie Carter, as an attempt by the union, the Communications Workers of America, to influence the ongoing contract talks. They said, quote, "Where's my Fios? Is a campaign orchestrated by leadership of the Communication Workers of America and its special interest supporters to try to gain an advantage in negotiations with Verizon for new labor contracts. The timing of the July 29th event, a protest that you staged, fewer than 4 days in advance of the expiration of the existing labor contract is evidence enough," close quote. What do you say to that?
I say that that also discounts the fact that the Smart City Report was just released, that we have been working on this for a couple of years now, and also that we're in the middle of a political campaign season. So now is the most effective time to make our city leaders listen and come up with a plan, and those people who want to lead our city, for them to propose a plan that will connect all of our communities to the 21st century economy. I think Verizon has a lot to answer to. If they want to link this to their contract negotiations, that's fine. But it doesn't answer the question of why they've not lived up to their commitments to build out Fios in Baltimore City, why they've continued to redline, why residents of Baltimore City are paying surcharges for the build out of Fios in other districts, but not able to access that here.
What is the Communication Workers of America's relationship with Maryland working families and with this protest?
We have gotten financial support from them in the past, but we're an organization that is largely supported around the country by labor organizations because we represent the workers that they also seek to represent.
I'm WIPR. This is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass, speaking with Charlie Carter, Executive Director of Maryland Working Families, and with Philip Spivak, co-leader of the Baltimore Broadband Campaign. Again, to this question of why Verizon has or hasn't done what it's done, they told us it's a business decision. Quote, "As we have noted since 2010, Verizon's focus is on completing our remaining fiber network build commitments under existing video franchises and increasing sales to homes and businesses in areas where our all fiber network is available. We're not looking to pursue new video franchises or expand our fiber network to new markets at this time." Charlie Carter, do you think it is a business decision?
I think that anything can be rationalized as a business decision, but it's up to our leaders. And it's up to us as the community to challenge those business decisions. We've given money to an entity, Verizon, to build out and supply our communities with high speed broadband internet access, and they fail to do so. So I think that it's tough to say when you have $47 billion in profits that you cannot invest a portion of that into a build-out.
Philip Spivak, is Fios the only option for fiber optic broadband?
No. So we don't focus as much on, is it going to be Verizon who's going to help or Comcast? And in fact, to us, it's a bit of a distraction, and it may not be the best solution. So what I mean by that is our thought is that what would be optimal is to have a fiber network in Baltimore that's neutral.
Is to say not owned by a provider?
So that means that either the city owns it, Or it means that an entity that is working for the city, such as a nonprofit outside the city, owns it. What it really means is that if it's open, it means multiple internet service providers can supply services over it. So what we think is better is to get beyond, we call them two myths. One is that the Comcast franchise is holding this up. The TV franchise has nothing to do with it. And the Verizon issue is an important issue, but they're not the necessary solution to the fiber, to bringing fiber into Baltimore.
And in simplest terms, what is the necessary solution in your view?
Well, the key thing at this point is for the city to declare its role. We want to hear the mayor say what their position is, because I think that is holding up progress. We don't think the city will choose to run a Baltimore broadband utility like in Chattanooga is an example. But we need the city to say that or not. We need the city then to say what will be the entity that will be empowered to represent the citizens of Baltimore. We're suggesting that that entity be outside the city. We think that it can be set up and implemented faster.
You mean geographically outside the city or outside the city government?
In a business relationship. So as a nonprofit acting on behalf of the city's interest. We're not in this for wiring up just five neighborhoods in North Baltimore. We want a balanced plan throughout the city. So what we hope to your question is that the city would establish what their role is and would acknowledge an entity that would act then on the city's behalf.
But I still don't see where you envision the investment money coming from, will be necessary to make a fiber optic system.
Yeah. So the dollars are going to come in a few ways. First of all, an enormous contribution of the city can occur by establishing a dig one policy. That means when they dig up your street that they put the fiber down. So you reduce the cost of what you need to raise by about 70% if you take advantage of public projects.
Charlie Carter, does that sound realistic to you?
Well, I think my question has always been about where that investment comes from. Where does the money come from to get it started? I agree with Philip that, that short of Verizon building out its network, having a public network would be a great alternative as long as we're reaching every community. I'm really hesitant to say that push forward with a plan that would only allow, certain communities to have access to it or to have access to it first while other communities lag behind. I think that just mirrors many of the problems that we have in this city to begin with.
Lots to think about. Will you keep in touch with us as this develops?
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you both. Charlie Carter is executive director of Maryland Working Families, which is protesting Verizon's refusal to bring high-speed Fios Internet to the city of Baltimore. Philip Spivak is co-leader of the Baltimore Broadband Campaign. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. More of this interview there, too. I'm Sheila Cast, ahead on Maryland Morning Movies. Stay with us on 88.1.
Is there an issue you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or leave us a voicemail at 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. Again, that's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
Good morning, everybody. Glad to have you with us this morning on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. Time now for our monthly Maryland Morning Movie Mayhem. I'm Tom Hall, joined in the studio by Ann Hornaday, the film critic for The Washington Post. Good to see you.
Hello, hello.
And joining us, as he does every August for the special August edition of the Maryland Morning Movie Mayhem, Jed Dietz, lounging somewhere on Martha's Vineyard. Jed, how you doing, man?
Good morning.
So as always, Ann and I have strung the hammock up here in the studio. We've got the little drinks with the umbrellas.
Yeah, the bluefish is grilling and the clams
is grilling,
are
that's right.
Marinating.
So don't think you're having all the fun here, you know. So Ann Hornaday, how are movies doing in general? I mean, is the movie business, you know, compared to, say, the game business or the, you know, the live entertainment business, is it up, down, neutral? What kind of year has 2015 been so far for the industry?
Well, I would say it's been a pretty good year. I think Jurassic World lifted all boats in many ways, and it really surprised everyone how well
that did. That was like the highest grossing movie in the history of high grossing movies.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think it managed to...
And bad reviews, too. So it was,
well, so-so reviews. I mean, it wouldn't be down in the red zone, but it wasn't. But I think it represented a movie that people could take their kids to. I mean, it's what they call a four-quadrant movie in terms of just everybody went. And I think that probably surprised a lot of the observers in the studios. But what's impressed me this year is that for years, especially exhibitors have been calling for studios to get out of summer. You know, there's been this logjam of movies opening in the summer because that's when they thought everybody went to the movies. And what a lot of theater owners and critics have been saying is, no, people want to go all year. Give us a nice, well-balanced diet year-round. And they are actually starting to do that. I mean, and things are hitting. I mean, movies are doing really well when they open in February and March. Things like Cinderella and 50 Shades of Grey and Furious 7, all of those opened, you know, earlier in the year. So I'm feeling like things are, for one thing, that calendar is balancing out better. And another sort of source of optimism for me is that for years, you know, we've been hearing Hollywood doesn't make the mid-budget adult-oriented drama anymore. But yet, year after year, they do. And even the big studios are in that business. We're seeing, you know, Sony tried this summer with Aloha, which unfortunately didn't work. They're trying it again this week with Ricky and the Flash. God bless them for still being in that business.
It's the Meryl Streep movie.
Indeed. Yeah.
And her daughter or two, I think.
Exactly. Universal is doing it with the Steve Jobs movie and Creed, and next week with Straight Outta Compton, which is kind of a baby boomer piece. And then, of course, we have the wonderful indies, you know, studios like A24, which brought out While We're Young, and the documentary Amy, and The End of the Tour, which we're seeing this week. So whether they're little indies or big studios, they actually are still making movies for grown-ups because grown-ups are still going to movies, which is making the industry still healthy. Mm-hmm.
And, Jed, when a movie like Jurassic Park or Jurassic World, whatever it's called, lifts all boats, does it lift the indie movies as well?
I think it does. I don't really know any data on it, but I think, you know, for 40 years, movie-going has been this huge event in American culture. I mean, much more than all major sports events, museum going, theater going, combined by a factor of two or three. And that really, it goes up and down a little bit, but that correlates with how good the movies are. Mm-hmm. But it's a pretty steady line. It's a big cultural art form. And I think the great thing is that it's big not only in its attendance, but very big in its artistic ambition and sweep. And I think the audiences get it and are fascinated by it.
Well, let's talk about some of the perhaps lesser-known movies as we usually do. We tend not to talk about the sort of big blockbusters, you know, Mission Impossible and that kind of stuff. We do talk about movies that may be a little bit off the radar. Ann Hornaday, here's a movie that was at the Maryland Film Festival. Jed had it this year, Bobcat Goldthwait's documentary called Call Me Lucky, about a guy named Barry Crimmins.
Yeah.
Good movie, huh?
Yeah, it's fascinating. It's a portrait of a guy who probably isn't that well known to most audiences. He was revered in the stand-up comedy circles in Boston in the 1980s and really put stand-up comedy on the map in Boston during that time. Bobcat was a mentee of his, Stephen Wright. The list just goes on and on and on. And Goldthwait has fashioned this kind of, I think it's part honor, you know, and testimonial to this guy. And then also this sort of galvanizing, electrifying portrait of someone with his own personal history that comes to light in the course of the film that sends his personal life and his professional life in a completely different direction. And he turns out to be enormously influential in areas of the public life that we also had no idea about. And I don't want to give too much away because part of it is sort of finding out these revelatory things about him. But it's just a sort of fascinating slice of pop culture life and also sort of our own social and political history.
Yeah, and Jed, I didn't get to see it, but I remember it being very, very well received at the film festival.
Very well received, and both Bobcat and Barry were there, and it was, again, without giving anything away, it was an incredibly moving screening. One thing I will tell you without giving anything away about the film, but just to underscore how important Barry Crimmins has been in the comedy world, Bobcat had been thinking about this as a narrative for quite a long time. And Robin Williams was a very close friend of Bobcat's and, you know, starred in a movie we had at the festival that Bobcat made called World's Greatest Dad, which I still think is one of Robin Williams' best performances. And Robin said, don't waste time on the narrative, make the documentary. And Bobcat said, well, gee, I've never done that. And Robin Williams said, well, I'll write you a check, start. Mm. And then he died. Mm-hmm. So it's dedicated to Robin.
Yeah. On 88.1, you're listening to Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall in the studio with Anne Hornaday, the film critic of The Washington Post. Jed Dietz, the director of the Maryland Film Festival, joins us from Martha's Vineyard. The Diary of a Teenage Girl, and this was another film related to, has a Maryland connection because this was one of a first-time director, Marielle Heller, who got a Maryland Film Festival Fellowship to develop this movie. Seems like an interesting plot. I saw the trailer mm-hmm. the other day, and it had me hooked.
Oh, it's just wonderful. It's a coming-of-age tale based on, and Jed, you'll have to help me with the pronunciation. Is it Phoebe Gleckner? The illustrated novel.
Yeah, the graphic novel, that's right.
Right, of a girl kind of coming-of-age, especially coming-of-age sexually in 1970s San Francisco. And it is, you know, it's just one of those sort of bracing portraits of girlhood that we don't really see. You know, we're really used to, you know, the male kind of, you know, sex comedy, for lack of a better word, of young men kind of exploring their sexuality and having adventures and getting into scrapes. And we don't really see young women in that kind of subjective role, you know, that agent role. And so it's a very refreshing portrait of that, and it's just been superbly made by Marielle. It reminded me of American Splendor in the way that it includes mm-hmm. illustrations and animations, and it's just a really densely layered, delightful film with a wonderful central performance and some great supporting performances by Kristen Wiig plays her mother. And Alexander Sarsgaard plays somebody with whom she has a love interest.
Belle Powley is the actress. She's 23 right. years old. She plays a 15-year-old girl in
quite
the movie.
Convincingly.
And Marielle Heller, Jed, you know her well, and she was part of this fellowship program. How does that work, and how did she use that fellowship to develop this movie?
Yeah, we started this fellowship before we had a film festival, which is sort of because we do it in partnership with the Sundance Labs, which were also started before Redford started the Sundance Film Festival. And they send us, these labs gestate emerging filmmaker projects. And the list of people that have come out of these labs is extraordinary. I mean, Wes Anderson, Quentin Tarantino, Paul Thomas Anderson, on and on. I mean, you would recognize many, many of the names of people who have come through these labs with their first project. And they send us, Michelle Satter runs the labs, and they send us 4 to 6 scripts about sort of end of August every year. And I put together a group of readers in Baltimore, none of whom have any connection to the film industry. That's one of the rules. Many of whom have never seen a script before, and we read them individually. I'm sort of the pivot point so that nobody influences other people's opinions. And then we give $10,000. We've split it a couple times, but we typically give $10,000 to one of the writer-directors. And I think we've done 18 of them now, 19, something like that, and 12 films have been made in marketed as a result of
that's a
process.
Huge batting average, isn't it? That's terrific.
Yeah,
that's great. All right, Diary of a Teenage Girl. Here's a movie directed by Noah Baumbach, another movie that is female centric.
Yes,
you know, a lot of the titles we've been talking about all summer have been female centric, which is great. It's called Mistress America, stars Greta Gerwig and Lola Kirk. It's a college freshman tale. You've both seen it. Anne, what do you think?
Oh, I was charmed by it. And I think Baumbach has just been on a roll lately. I really loved While We're Young, which opened earlier this spring. Yeah. This is kind of a bookend with, well, with that in some ways, but also with Frances Ha, which he also did with mm-hmm. Gerwig a couple of years ago, which I also
love that
found
movie.
Beguiling.
And she's a terrific actress.
She's
so
a force
quirky
of nature.
And fun.
I know.
And, yeah.
She is. I just, you know, she's got, I use the term creatureliness. You know, there's this kind of almost feral quality about her that is so sort of unstudied and spontaneous and utterly beguiling. And daffy in a kind of old school way. And this film completely exploits all of those qualities. And it has this kind of retro screwball quality. It's very stylized in terms of the dialogue and the mood and the tone. It's not gritty or naturalistic. It goes off, it's about this young woman who's sort of at large in Manhattan, fancy free. She's almost like a Holly Golightly character. And then this young college student played by Lola Kirk in a wonderful breakout performance, I thought, sort of starts tagging along with her. And it's about their relationship and about kind of finding your identity and finding your way in life. But you never know. One of my tests for if I, you know, if a movie is working for me or not is, can I tell where it's going? Is it predictable? And I never knew where this was going. It was just this wonderful kind of daffy ride through New York and other environs that I found just utterly charming.
Yeah. What do you think, Jed? Mistress America.
Yeah, I agree. I saw it at Sundance, so I also had the pleasure, which confirmed all the charm and everything Anne said of the Q&A with Greta and Noah afterwards. It's one of these movies, I mean, another test of a movie, I would say, is when it's over, you sort of reflect that nobody else but this team could have done that movie. You know, it's so singular. And I think this one's, I would just add to everything Anne said by saying this is also a very singular movie-going experience in the most wonderful way.
Indeed, yeah. And I just, he's doing something, Noah Baumbach, that it's kind of bold in this era where things do tend to be more naturalistic and they want to get sort of down and dirty and rough and pessimistic. And he's injecting this whole sort of new, not new, but I think boldly optimistic tone to these stories that I really welcome.
I think you're right, and I think actually Diary of a Teenage Girl is a completely different style movie, but the same thing.
Agreed.
There's this hopeful thread, despite some shock in it and, you know.
And sadness.
Sadness and mistakes that are made. There's a tremendously hopeful, courageous, people can get through stuff tone.
Yes.
And in this case, it's an emerging girl.
Yes.
You know, emerging woman, a girl emerging to a woman.
Yeah.
And in both of these cases, it's very hopeful. It's really interesting.
Yeah. Mistress America. We got time, just a little time to talk about one more movie. And Lily Tomlin is starring.
Oh, yeah.
And it's her first starring role in the last 27 years. It's a movie called Grandma. Paul Weitz did this movie. Anne Hornaday. By the way, I've seen the Grace and Frankie series on Netflix, most of it with Lily Tomlin and Jane Fonda. I love that.
It's so great to see her back.
Thing. Yeah, she is such a great artist.
She really is. And apparently, I actually got to interview her last year for the Kennedy Center Honors, which she received. And she talked a little bit about this and said that Weitz really wrote it for her. He really fashioned it around her. And she plays this kind of counterculture figure living in California, and her granddaughter shows up on her doorstep with an unplanned pregnancy, and they need to spend the day figuring out what to do about it, whether to terminate or bring to term, and if to terminate, then to get the money together to make that happen. And so it's just a very sort of, you know, it's a very tightly focused piece and a real showcase for her. And I thought it was just it's a very affecting, nice little movie, and it's just a chance to, again, like we were saying, it's just a chance to see her kind of front and center again, which we need more
she's
of.
She's terrific. All right, Grandma with Lily Tomlin. Well, that's all the time we have this morning. Anne Hornaday, always great to see you. Many
thanks.
And Jed Dietz, thank you for giving up a little of your grilling and chilling time to do the movie mayhem. Appreciate it.
No, it's always fun to be with you.
All right, we will see you next month on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning. We'll have a list of the movies that we talked about this morning on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Jed Dietz, the director of the Maryland Film Festival, and Hornaday, the film critic for the Washington Post. I'm Tom Hall. It's Maryland Morning. Lots more coming up. Thanks for being with us. Stick around.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Tomorrow, a group of craft manufacturers will open a new pop-up store at 16 West North Avenue, just west of Charles Street, showcasing locally made Baltimore goods. Two members of what's called the Industrial Arts Collective, the alliance that helped start the shop, are with me in the studio to talk about how the city can better support the growing number of small-scale manufacturers here. Sarah Templin is owner of Radica Textiles, a hand-drawn, screen-painted textile shop based in Baltimore. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And also here is Jeremiah Jones, who owns Sew Lab, a company that sews products for companies in Baltimore. He also owns Hold Fast LLC, a bicycle components and accessories business. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
How did you get started making handmade goods?
Well, I actually began in college making sculptures from textiles, and from there became more interested in the surface design of the textiles itself. Drawing on textiles was a natural evolution for me from the sculpture that I was doing, and printing was always interesting to me, so it was a pretty obvious evolution for me.
And how about you, Jeremiah?
Well, I come from a pretty big family of handy people. My father does historic restoration and my mother's a painter. So I was always raised with making stuff rather than buying it. So it's just been trained in me, I guess.
And what inspired creation of this pop-up store?
Well, actually, I would say even to take a step further back, the Industrial Arts Collective came about as a group of makerspaces who are interested in forming an alliance in order to bolster.
Let's go even further back.
Sure.
Makerspaces. What
so
does that
makerspaces
mean?
Is a term for open access facilities where you can fabricate your own products. So, for instance, Baltimore Print Studios could be considered a makerspace because they are a studio on North Avenue for letterpress and screen printing. So they offer courses, but they also offer studio space that you can book to work on your own projects.
And so the Industrial
Arts Collective,
Collective
began as a group of seven makerspaces. From there, it really organically evolved to include designers and manufacturers as well. And since one of our core missions is to support and bolster the local design and maker community, it seemed pretty clear that we should do some sort of maker pop-up shop. So that's one of our first big initiatives is the store.
Are there existing brick-and-mortar stores in Baltimore that would be interested in your products?
Yeah.
Absolutely. 16 Tons is on the Avenue in Hamden. They carry a lot of the products that we make, and their sister store, Double Dutch, which is upstairs, carries products that come out of Sarah's and my shop. So
yeah.
we make the bags that she prints.
So yeah, tell me about the products. What are some of the products?
Well, we have 80 vendors right now registered, all Baltimore manufacturers and makerspaces, and it is incredibly diverse. It's funny that people think that manufacturing doesn't exist in the city. Well, not funny, but it is not totally true. It just tends to be possibly a lot of smaller manufacturers. So we have, for instance, a bike manufacturer, a drone manufacturer, many printers,
hats,
lots
jewelry,
of hats, jewelry, ceramics, many furniture designers and manufacturers, concrete manufacturers. One person is selling 3D printers. You can actually buy a 3D printer in our store. Dog gear, floor mats, all sorts of products.
Tote bags,
clothing, yoga clothes, women's apparel, lots of leather goods.
Got it.
It's very diverse.
A lot of different
stuff.
On WIPR, this is Marilyn Morning. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Sarah Templin, business owner, one of the organizers of the pop-up shop, and Jeremiah Jones, owner of SoLab and of Holdfast LLC. They're both members of the Industrial Arts Collective. So beyond selling goods made here in the city, I gather one of your goals is to function as an online resource for collaboration and education.
That's true.
What's that about?
Well, we have a calendar. If you are a member of the Industrial Arts Collective, and pretty much anybody can sign up on our website, wemakebaltimore.com, you have an opportunity to post events on our community calendar. So that could be, for instance, a pop-up shop that you're having of your own, workshops that you're hosting, any kind of meetups where possibly you want to meet other people making products as well. Of course, you can also just go to the calendar and see what kind of events we have on there.
Resource sharing. So some manufacturers or makers in the city might require other manufacturers to make components or part of their process for them. So it's a good network for small businesses like us facing the everyday challenges of running a business.
Jeremiah, your company, SoLab, has 7 employees.
Yes.
And you can't find people younger than retirement age who have the skills to do the sewing work that you need. Is that right?
That is correct. Manufacturing, particularly in our field, which is sewing, so needle and thread, has been outsourced for the last 30 years to overseas nations. So with that went a lot of jobs and a lot of tradition, skill sets passed down. So effectively, we've had to kind of make our own path and create job training programs within our shop to give people the skills and tools they need to.
So this is like an apprenticeship?
Yeah, pretty much all of our employees have come through our shop by way of apprenticeship. It's unofficial. We're kind of a small incubator. So within our shop, we all of our employees, or most of our employees actually, have their own brands that they're working on. So through their process, we let them use our assets, our experience and knowledge to bring their own products to market or to just to manufacture even. So acting as a consultant. So at the end of the day, we're hoping that our employees are going to branch off and go out and start their own businesses, making their own things to further our advancement in bringing manufacturing back to the United States.
Do you pick up that there is a big interest in Baltimore of people who want to learn to make things?
I hear every day people want to know how to make a bag.
I would second that, and I would say that a big interest of the Industrial Arts Collective is job creation and preventing brain drain. Just so often we hear about people leaving Baltimore because they can't find jobs in a creative field. One thing that we're very interested in with the Industrial Arts Collective is supporting the companies, our member organizations, our member vendors, and their own business development. As they create more jobs, it helps the entire overall community. For every one manufacturing job that's created, it supports 2.5 other auxiliary positions. So supporting manufacturing jobs is a big mandate of ours, both through supporting the individual companies, but also these apprenticeship programs like what Jeremiah is doing.
Well, thank you for telling us about it, and good luck.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Sarah Templin is a business owner and one of the organizers of the pop-up shop. Jeremiah Jones is owner of SoLab and Holdfast LLC. They're both members of the Industrial Arts Collective. The pop-up store will be open Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays from 12 to 8 p.m. starting Saturday through September 26th. It's all located in the D Center at 16 West North Avenue. Got more information on our website, wypr.org/Marilyn Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. Marilyn Morning is an original production
of Your Public Radio,
WYPR,
in Baltimore.
The show is produced by Jonna McCone
and Connor Graham.
We have production help from
Christy Forrest
and Scott Seiss.
Coffee for our guests provided by Zeke's Coffee in Lauraville. On the web at zekescoffee.com.
I'm Tom Hall.
And I'm Sheila Cast. Tomorrow is August 8th, significant in Maryland history as the birth date of Cecilius Calvert, 2nd Baron Baltimore, in 1605. He became the first proprietor of the Maryland colony in 1632. He never set foot in Maryland, but governed from England by deputies until his death at age 70, when his only son Charles succeeded him. Cecil's wife was Anne Arundel. We're coming back Monday. Please come along.